The Guardian.
Hello, this is Politics Weekly. I'm Allegra Stratton.
And I'm Tom Clark.
This week, Lib Dems in Liverpool lined up to tell Nick Clegg, "You'll never walk alone."
While in Manchester, Labour prepares to anoint a new leader.
To chew through all of this, we have three stalwarts of the party conference circuit, fresh from the dark, airless room in Liverpool where we've spent the last week. Polly Toynbee, Seamus Milne, and back in his home in Chiswick, Michael White.
Do you want to give them my full address there? Postcode, where we keep the spare key.
Now, Polly, let's just begin with the Lib Dems. Seemed to me that Vince Cable rather outshone his boss. Do you think the delegates went away happy enough with Nick Clegg's speech?
I think Vince Cable's speech was the star turn. Nick Clegg's speech was adequate. It was highly mendacious and full of a lot of extraordinarily tendentious things, but it did the business. Not wonderful. They didn't sort of rise to their feet hundreds of times and applaud loudly, but it was all right.
But what about this, two is better than one, it's our joint programme for government and I believe in it, rather than striking the tone Vince did of saying we had to do a deal and we got some pretty good things as well as some things that stick in the teeth a bit?
That's exactly the question. In every single fringe you went to, even people who, you know, who are very loyal and didn't in any way want to rebel were saying, but we need wedges. We need wedge issues. We need things that define us so that when we're on the doorstep next May and thereafter, we can say, well, look, we're for this, not that. And our leader says so too.
Mike, did you think that they came up with these wedges successfully? You've got the press pack wanting wedges, also known as splits.
Well, we exist within what I like to call the adversarial paradigm. And if we can't find a split or a division or a wedge, if you like, we create one. Polly could create one alone in a darkened room. That's the way we do our business. They get very cross with us, by the way. I interviewed a couple of sweet middle-aged women, I thought they were. Boy, did they tear a strip off me. Well, they wanted to tear three strips off Polly, but she wasn't there, so they tore a couple off me.
But Mike,
they think, as all conferences think, we're attending a parallel conference, quite different from the one which the press is attending. And that at all conferences, they've got a point.
But did you think, I mean, there were a couple of issues where ministers, Lib Dem ministers, bear saying again, came up with distinct policy positions precisely so that their people could go on the doorstep and not be bashed. For instance, on Trident, this is quite interesting now, isn't it?
Well, yes. And Nick Carvey, the junior minister, has to work with Liam Fox, which must be tough. It was quite explicit. He said, you know, we postponed Trident. It puts Labour on the spot, doesn't it, at the next election? Of course, you shouldn't say those sort of things.
Not if Ed Miliband wins.
Yes, that's true. But let's see what happens. But that was a bit too a piece of explicit calculation. But it was a wedge calculation against Labour rather than the Tories. Vince, as you say, put up lots of them. And they have all sorts of issues which they come up with. But I would want to stress the conference was trying to make the best of this awkward civil partnership it's in with the Tories and saying, yes, we are distinctive, we're fighting our corner, we're making gains, we stopped them doing these foolish things, we pulled them around to our point of view on the bank tax or something, and of course we're giving David Cameron an excuse not to listen to his more loony right-wingers, they always abuse them, on things like Europe.
Seamus, there were things, of course, where the delegates, despite their loyalty, did stand up and make a bit of a show of it against the leadership, most notably on academy schools. I thought the response from the platform was interesting. It wasn't so much, look, we're in a coalition, we've got to grow up. It was, you, the delegates, don't understand what liberal means. If you were real liberals, you'd support this stuff.
Yeah, I thought that debate was very interesting, and the vote was bigger against the platform than I'd expected, because I agree with Mike that, you know, the overall tone of the conference was on the coalition broadly supportive in principle. But on many of these key issues, you know, the distance between ordinary Liberal Democrat activists and members and the Clegg group that's running the party really was shown to be very large. I thought that debate more than any other because, you know, the vast majority of Liberal Democrat activists, you know, believe in local accountable schools and don't want anything to do with academies and free schools of the type that Michael Gove is forcing through. And now the response of the leadership to that was to say, well, you know, the deal's done, these things are going through, we won't pay any attention to them, which is a traditional Labour leadership response to a conference vote. But I think because the Liberal Democrats are so well dug into education and local councils around the country, I think that's going to be much more of a sort of locally fought issue. And I think it could be quite a significant element in the way the coalition pans out on the ground in real life, in real towns and cities around Britain.
Not just education, but health too. I heard a lot of people deeply distressed by the sudden revolution in running the health service after, you know, it was not in the coalition agreement. What are they doing? Uprooting the whole thing all over.
I think they were a bit wrong-footed on that, you know, on that, on the change of primary care trust going over to GP commissioning. And of course, on the schools, Gove promised us all there'd be a great surge of demand for this stuff, and there hasn't been. It's Gove who's been damaged so far, not local education by this one.
Mike, what did you mean by that? Because there is some, I think Lib Dems ministers feel that the top-down reorganisation was in the coalition document. What do you, when you mean they were wrong-footed,
how do they think that? I don't understand.
Well, it depends who you talk to. But certainly I've picked up the impression this week in Liverpool that Lansley caught them all a bit by surprise. In fact, I think he caught everybody by surprise with this sweep towards comprehensive replacement of primary care trusts. They're not particularly good, but they were getting better with GP-led commissioning, because anybody who ever knows a doctor knows that not many of them strike you as particularly entrepreneurial. They're often rather depressed chaps who
Allegra,
drink and smoke.
What do you mean
much.
About that point about the, being in the coalition agreement? Definitely isn't.
No, I know it's not, but that Lib Dem ministers feel that the sort of intent... there's weasel word that the intent of it is in the coalition document.
Well, it
that
wasn't, because Lansley, interestingly, wisely, had always said the one thing I'm not going to do is repeat Labour's mistakes of uprooting the entire NHS, turning it on its head, make everybody reapply for their job. And then suddenly, you know, within weeks of the coalition agreement, he's done it on the back of an envelope without thinking about more and more bits of the NHS that have to be
sorted. And no piloting either,
else.
That's the other thing.
I suppose it's interesting, very interesting in and of itself, because it's a bolt from the blue. But it's also interesting because the way the Lib Dem ministers are dealing with the perception they've been ambushed is to lash out.
Not to read The Guardian.
Right. I mean, I didn't want to mention because it's so self-referential. But yeah, that it is about the media. I mean, it was also striking again.
This was Paul Burstow, who had a outburst against the paper, which was...
For spreading
surprising.
Lies and...
He's
and,
a perfectly nice, harmless fellow. But fringe meeting for him. He didn't...
I got quite a bollocking at a fringe meeting where I was rash enough to speak. And certainly they were very angry with us. It was a meeting of the social liberal reform group with
dangerous lefties.
Dangerous lefties with dangerous lefties like Shirley Williams.
We give them a lot of space in this newspaper.
Well, it was packed out, and Shirley Williams was indeed strongly against the education policy, strongly against the health policy, and strongly against the cuts too soon, too deep.
But are we being too dismissive here? Is there something in the kind of Nick Clegg Orange Book idea that the old state has failed, and that you know, we've had 50 years, 60 years for local education authorities to raise up the standards for the poorest kids? It hasn't worked.
No, it has. Yes, it has.
Has
for
it worked?
A lot of people, yeah.
Yes, because
problems.
What we've got now is that the what was average, an average school in 1997 is now the back marker in terms of standards. There's been a real uplift in the standards in schools.
But it's still true, isn't it, that the UK's got quite a long tail of quite bad schools compared to other countries?
Well, that's certainly true, but the evidence isn't that is specifically that marketising schools in the public funded schools is not the way to improve results. I mean, that's true in Sweden and many other places besides. And I mean, you know, the evidence is pretty well built up. And I thought it was the case was very, very well put by the guy from Cambridge,
Councillor Peter Downs.
Downs, yeah, in the education debate. And, you know, there's a guy who's been a head teacher, knows the system, knows local education like the back of his hand. And, I mean, he basically drove a coach and horses through that argument.
So, and incidentally, our education system is now up to European average standard. So it's, you know, we're no longer tailing behind. Could be better.
Polly Toynbee has a copy of her book, The Verdict of Labour's Years, in her bag. But Mike, what happens now? You have Nick Clegg being perceived to be much more ideologically in bed with the Tories, and you have Vince, who sort of seems to be allowed to go and be less. He said, you know, what's it like being in bed with the Tories? Well, they steal the duvet. That's what he said in his speech. What does he become the figurehead in the next few years, or actually is he very happy and there will be no such split?
Well, he had one of many good lines in his speech. He said, you know, people say I look miserable. I'm sorry, delegates, this is my happy face. He's a sort of Lib Dem Hamlet in a way, and he makes a lovely speech, and he's got good tone, and he's a clever man. He's an academic, on the other hand. He understands both sides of the argument, I'm told. He finds that hard to take decisions. My hunch is that he does like the limelight a bit, and it's a bit like Gandhi. We think of him as saintly, disinterested St. Vincent of Cable, but in fact, he's a bit of a problem for some of his colleagues. He gives Clegg a hard time. He's always quoting speeches he made last year to prove something, but in fact, Vince, like most people during the economic crisis, has been all over the shop, so he's always made a speech on one to support a particular position, but he also made speeches to support other positions. I think he'll stay on in myself. He's 67. He probably enjoys it more than he dislikes it. He's not a comfortable guy in that sense anyway. He's introspective and sort of agonizing. He's just clever and he's amusing and we like him, but you know, like everybody else, he makes mistakes and he contradicts himself. And he faces the two problems, the two big roadblocks ahead of this coalition, which are one, the May the 7th referendum on alternative vote. If they lose it, they're in difficulty. And second, I'm trying to avoid the elephant in the room cliche, but I can't, is, you know, have they called the cuts right? Will they damage the fragile economic recovery? And that outshadows everything we've been talking about.
If those two tests are missed, Seamus, the question in my mind watching Nick Clegg's speech, where he said this is our joint programme for government and I believed in it, is what reason does he leave his activist with in order to go out and give out leaflets for him?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, Vince Cable is obviously licensed not just by Nick Clegg but by Cameron and the Tories to do the kind of thing he's been doing this week, because they need someone to absorb some of the anxiety from the Liberal Democrat Party, really, as a whole. But I think, you know, there was a very revealing section in Nick Clegg's speech and in the pre-briefing that he did for it at the weekend, which was about the Liberal Democrats, you know, are never going to be a repository for disaffected left-wing Labour voters. And, of course, that is turning a problem into an opportunity because, of course, that he's lost those voters. Those voters have gone, as the opinion polls show. You know, there's a whole swathe of people who supported the Lib Dems at the general election who are not going to vote Lib Dem again. And so, you know, the party is in a situation where, you know, it is tied to the Cameron chariot. There's no way it can escape from it. From the point of view of Nick Clegg and his group, they're ideologically committed to a lot of that stuff anyway, but a lot of the party isn't.
And a lot of them were absolutely aghast at the idea of turning away any voters.
He didn't say that, you know. He said, we're not just a repository for these people who came across fed up with Labour.
Paddy, well, it didn't come across that way.
It didn't
seem as his intent. And there is, and after
but they're
all,
lost anyway.
I wouldn't count on it. I think that there always needs to be an escape valve, and there always will, for all sorts of ragbags of voters for different reasons in different places who don't want to vote for either of the other two, and particularly under our first-past-the-post system where you've got to hold your nose and vote for the least worst.
Well, the subject we're skirting round here is whether the Liberal Democrats are going to be able to envisage a Liberal-Labour coalition in the future. Anyone interested in the answer to that question, of course, is going to have to be keeping an incredibly close eye on events in Manchester this weekend. On Saturday afternoon, just after 4:30, we'll find out which of the five candidates has been elected as leader of the Labour Party. And of course, we've heard from each of those contenders on this very podcast over the past 2 months.
The great motors of progressive politics over a century have been, on the one hand, the social democratic commitment to social justice through collective action. That's one side of it. And the other side of it is a commitment to individual freedom in a market economy. And sometimes those are called liberal or radical liberal or social liberal.
There's, you know, a difference between, say, me and David Miliband on public services reform. I think that David's more inclined to want to continue some of the more market-based, more individualised approach to reform and public services. I'm more sceptical about whether that's either fair or delivers value for money.
I'm very familiar and comfortable with the idea of communities helping themselves without the state there. But you can't be the MP for Hackney and welcome the idea that somehow the state is going to divest itself of some of its responsibilities and the community, some amorphous community, is going to take over.
Some big ideas and a philosophy which underpins them. And I'm saying that what the party needs going forward is the best of old and new Labour. And I describe that as aspirational socialism. And I think the ideas can resonate.
What I've said, if I'm the leader of the Labour Party, is I will look at the precise balance of taxation and spending within a deficit reduction plan. And I will indicate where we are on that by the time of the spending review on October the 20th.
So then, Seamus, which way is it going to go?
Well, I think it would be a brave person who would make a prediction. It'd be interesting to see whether my colleagues do. But I think it's swung this way and that in the last 2 weeks. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, all the betting money was moving in the direction of Ed Miliband, and there were definitely MPs moving in his direction who'd previously signed up to David. And the last week, I think, particularly under the impact of quite a strong media campaign, it seems to have swung back in the other direction. Quite a lot of money's going into the in William Hill, into the David Miliband box. So we'll know on Saturday.
Polly, you predicting or not really?
Absolutely not. I think it's one of the most unpredictable elections. It's a very small electorate. It's very diverse and difficult. You know, in the deputy leadership election, only 8%.
Actually, it's a very big electorate, but a lot of them might vote.
I mean, in the deputy leadership election, of the trade union eligible trade union voters, only 8% voted. So who knows?
And that poll that put Ed Miliband ahead, the YouGov one recently, they had a turnout of 34% for that trade union section, which is what people who think David Miliband will still win are pointing to as a, it won't be 8% in that section, it'll probably be a turnout of 16%, but it's not 34. So if you discount that, and then
there was a contradiction in the YouGov results, which I noticed,
this is getting nerdy.
It's quite revealing, which is that although it gave Ed Miliband the lead narrowly, it also showed a majority thinking that David Miliband would more likely win as Prime Minister. Now, whether they're right or wrong about that, if people think that, obviously, in the centre ground, they're going to move towards him as a candidate.
I've certainly come across a lot of people who, with their hearts, are Edists, but decided to vote David because they were convinced by the enormous great press campaign there's been, saying David is the one who can win, and David is the one that Cameron fears. And that's, you know, Labour people are serious and they want to win, and if that's what they think, that will be partly why.
Mike, does it seem to you that, like, we've all got very excited about souping up small differences between these two very similar brothers?
Yeah, I feel a bit that way. I'm sure they'll be sharing Christmas dinner together, despite what we've attempted to do. In fairness to us, well, I suppose we've attempted to make this a psychodrama because it hasn't been enormously an ideological drama. And although I risk Allegra contradicting me, I don't think there's a huge amount between the brothers. And with the exception of Diane Abbott, who is, you know, an important symbolic presence.
I agree with you, and it's exactly what I wrote in my column.
Well, just fancy, Polly. But the head and heart business intrigues me. People have been cautious about calling this one on the programme. 30-odd years ago, when there was a Labour leadership contest, brilliant field. Jim Callaghan, Michael Foot, Dennis Healy, Roy Jenkins, Tony Benn and Tony Crossland. And I thought, well, Crossland is the man who ticks most of the boxes. He's radical, he's clever, he's not afraid of the civil service or anybody else. And, of course, he came last. And I learned from that, people like us don't pick Labour leaders. We think we do, and Fleet Street is full of people who think they do, but we don't. Having said that, my hunch is, and I think this is the mood of the meeting, is that they will probably go for head over heart for David over, it's only a hunch, over Ed. And I say, why not? Because, let's be brutally frank, the next leader of the Labour Party will be very lucky to be Prime Minister. We know how it goes. The Tories and the Labour Party took three each discarded before they got back into power in the last 25 years. And for young Eddie, what's the hurry, lad? You can let your brother be leader of the Labour Party.
Oh, don't count on
still,
history repeating
you're
itself,
still
Mike.
In contention. Yeah, I don't count on anything. I merely observe that the next leader of the Labour Party, you know, it's what you might call, it's like being a neat, really. It's a dead-end job.
I disagree with Mike on that. I mean, I think that reading off the recent history is a mistake that people often make in politics, because,
yep,
they're, you know, just because, you know, Blair won three times and Thatcher won, was it three times? Yes. That doesn't mean it's going to repeat itself like that before. Before that period, before the Thatcher period, governments were alternating very rapidly. And I think that was to do with it being a period of social and economic crisis and instability. And we're now back into a period of economic crisis and perhaps social instability after a long boom that went on for many years. So
yep,
I don't think that we should assume that that's the case at all. And I think it's very likely that Labour could win the next election. So that'll be another factor that voters will be thinking. Labour Party voters will be thinking.
Thatcher would have lost if it hadn't been for the Falklands War.
No, she would not. That's a comforting delusion of people on the left. Michael Foot couldn't have won an election if she wasn't standing.
I think, and I'll stick my neck out here, I think probably Ed Miliband will inch it, just because I think that the people who are motivated and bothered to turn out in the trade union and constituency section are more likely to want that signal of difference from what's gone before. And obviously we'll see if I'm right or wrong on Saturday, and I've got no more idea than anyone else. But Polly...
I mean, the low turnout that Allegra was talking about in the trade union section would actually favour Ed, I think, because the main unions are campaigning for him, and so the more active people are more likely to follow that.
So, I mean, who knows? I mean, we can all speculate merrily, and most people are saying it's quite close, and maybe it'll be one of the others who we haven't even talked about. But and Ed Balls has certainly had the best campaign.
And that should be noted. He's just too associated with Gordon Brown's failures and a bit toxic at the box office.
But he may have deserved himself the shadow chancellorship, whoever wins, because he's been bloody brilliant.
But may not get it because he's been so good.
But isn't the big... If we're talking about head and heart, and maybe all this is a bit exaggerated, isn't the real point here that because... Not so much because of who Ed Miliband is, but because of the kind of left-leaning campaign he's had, he's going to get properly crucified by a right-wing press if he wins, in a way that the others wouldn't.
Yes, we've set up for the Red Ed, which is absurd, as if somehow there was a difference between the brothers to match the stretch between, you know, a Healy and a Ben, and that's ridiculous. And I think it will be much harder. But I think whichever brother wins, they're both going to have to aim off the way they've been caricatured, because there's been a lot of caricaturing unfair of David Miliband too. Because he's got all of the old Blair, you know, he's got the Blair-Mandelson-Gould machine behind him, people assume that, you know, they think he's going to be Blair Mark II back to 97, hooray. It's not so at all. He's much more radical, much more interesting, has a lot of new ideas, and always has had. And I think that we'll be surprised, and he'll need to show his radicalism, and Ed will have to show his caution and pragmatism.
Well, I don't think there's any problem about Ed showing his caution and pragmatism, because he's done plenty of that already. I think Polly's absolutely right that whichever of them wins, they will win narrowly, and they will face a very large vote that has clearly been against them. Although I wouldn't want to exaggerate, I do think there is slightly more political difference between them than somehow has been suggested by the others. And so whichever of them wins will have to accommodate the opposition to them. So if David wins, he'll have to take account of the fact that nearly 50% of people will have transferred to Ed. So so I think on both sides that will be quite a complex series of negotiations. Actually, some of them have started already. There are already contacts between the two sides about what will happen in either option.
So what's the best idea that's been talked about, this Labour leadership contest?
Actually, not very much.
It's
been much more about strategy. It's about, you know, Ed Miliband saying, listen, we lost 5 million votes. 4 million of those votes didn't go to the Tories. They went, on the whole, either nowhere or to leftish or nationalist or green or somewhere else. And if we can only get those back, then we'll be back to 97. And the strategy of the Davidites has been to say, hang on, no, that's not the case. You know, it's fought on the middle ground. Watch out. Look where the coalition is. They've come right onto the middle ground. Coalition has been a gift to Cameron to occupy that space he was trying to occupy anyway. We're going to have to fight damn hard to get back there.
And so the two questions, one is, you know, what is the middle ground? And that'll be the next battle, because that's quite a crucial point in politics. And then the second issue is how you slice up those 5 million votes. And it's been quite an interesting, the lost votes, and it's quite an interesting argument between them about, you know, how you analyse the different bits of that 5 million. I mean, more than 3 million of them are either manual workers or unskilled white-collar workers, which I think is the point that Ed's campaign has been driving home, and that you've got to appeal to those people.
Middle England, people on 25,000.
Yeah. It might be economic insecurity. Obviously, that's a very important factor in the times in which we live. But it's also, I'm afraid, it's things like disappointment about crime and antisocial behaviour on the street, which is the subject of a quite shameful report by the Chief Inspector of Constabulary this week. People stay at home for lots of reasons. They just get fed up. They get fed up with people. They get fed up with policies.
I'm afraid we're going to leave that there, because Michael White's going to be bringing you from his daily podcast on Sunday a little more on the Labour leadership result when we actually have some facts. But for the meantime, that's it for this week. So thanks an awful lot to Mike himself and to Polly Toynbee and to Seamus Mill.
I'm Allegra Stratton. He's Tom Clark. The producer was Phil Maynard. Thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.